Valerie Bertinelli. The show, called Sydney, followed the exploits of Valerie as a private eye, and I played her fast-talking brother. That's all you'll ever need to know about those 13 episodes. Sydney was canceled after one half season. But despite its failure to ignite audiences, I'll never forget two things about Sydney. First, Valerie's lawyer love interest in the show was played by an actor named Craig Bierko. Almost immediately after meeting Craig on the set, I called Hank Azaria and said, "He sounds the way we do," which was the highest praise I could give someone. But before I could truly get to see how funny Craig was, there was a second thing I should tell you about Sydney. During filming, I fell madly in love with Valerie Bertinelli, who was clearly in a troubled marriage and truly getting off on two of the funniest guys on the planet adoring her and heaping their attention on her. Valerie Bertinelli, those seven syllables once stirred every part of my soul and other parts. In the early 1990s, there was no one more attractive than Valerie. Not only was she stunning and vivacious, but she also had this great, booming, adorable laugh, which Craig and I longed to hear all day long. Now that Craig and I were cast, it was as if Valerie had two new clowns to play with, and we threw ourselves into those roles with abandon, and the three of us had a lot of fun. But for me, being on Sydney and playing the fool with Valerie was more than just fun. It was serious shit. I was having to hide my love for her as we worked. This wouldn't be the last time this happened, which was desperately difficult. My crush was crushing. Not only was she way out of my league, but she was also married to one of the most famous rock stars on the planet, Eddie Van Halen. When we were making Sydney, Eddie's band, Van Halen, were in the middle of a string of four back-to-back number one albums. They were arguably the biggest band on the planet in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and Eddie was arguably the greatest rock guitarist on the planet at the time, too. As for me, I was always able to get laid because I would make women laugh, but I knew that being funny always came in second to musicians. In the world of music, there's a hierarchy, too. It's my contention that bass players tend to get laid first because they're stolid and cool and their fingers move in a gentle yet powerful way, except for Paul McCartney. He never got laid first. Drummers come next because they're all power and grit. Then guitarists because they get those fancy solos. Then, weirdly, the lead singer, because even though he's out there up in front, he never quite looks fully sexy when he has to throw his head back and reveal his molars and hit a high note. Whatever the correct order, I knew I was way behind Eddie Van Halen. Not only was he a musician, which means he was able to get laid more easily than someone who was funny, but he was also already married to the object of my desire. It is important to point out here that my feelings for Valerie were real. I was completely captivated. I mean, I was obsessed with her and harbored elaborate fantasies about her leaving Eddie Van Halen and living out the rest of her days with me. I was 19. I lived in a one-bedroom apartment on Laurel Canyon in Burbank called Club California, mind you. But fantasies and first loves don't know about real estate. They don't know about real anything. I didn't stand a fucking chance. Of course. That said, there was one night. I was over at Valerie and Eddie's house, just hanging out and gazing at Valerie, trying to make her laugh. When you made her laugh, you felt 10 feet tall. As the night progressed, it was clear that Eddie had enjoyed the fruits of the vine a little too hard one more time, and eventually he just passed out, not 10 feet away from us. But still, this was my chance. If you think I didn't actually have a chance in hell, you'd be wrong, dear listener. Valerie and I had a long, elaborate makeout session. It was happening. Maybe she felt the same way I did. I told her I had thought about doing that for a very long time, and she said it right back to me. Heaven eventually wrapped up, and I hopped in my black Honda CRX and headed back to Club California with a hard-on that could have propped up the Leaning Tower of Pisa. and a 19-year-old head flooded with dreams of a life spent with the object of my affection, obsession. I told Craig Bierko about this the following day, and he passed on some desperately needed advice and reality, though it was advice I wasn't ready to take. "Be careful," he said. "Oh, he's just jealous," I thought as I prepared for the following day of work, but this time as Valerie as my new girlfriend. The following day at work did not go as I expected it would. Valerie made no mention of what had happened and was behaving, as she should have been, like this was just a normal day. I quickly got the hint and also played the role as I was supposed to, but inside I was devastated. Many a tearful night, and spending the bulk of my daytime sleeping off hangovers in my tiny trailer, not to mention hours and hours of watching Craig's part get bigger as Valerie's love interest on the show, all made for a very sad, disillusioned teenager. The show did very badly, and I was so grateful that 4 weeks after the fateful night, Sydney got canceled, and I didn't have to see Valerie anymore. She, of course, had done nothing wrong, but having to see her every day and pretend I was fine about everything reminded me too much of what I had to do every day with my mother back in Ottawa, Canada. I've spent my life being attracted to unavailable women. It doesn't take a psychology degree to figure out that this had something to do with my relationship with my mother. My mother captivated every room she entered. I vividly remember being at some fancy ballroom when I was about 6 years old, and when my mom came in, every head in the room turned. I wanted her to turn and look at me in these moments, but she was working and could not. It took me only 37 years to work that one out. Ever since then, I have been addicted to the turn. Once the turn happened, I could start making a woman laugh and making her want me sexually. Once the sex was done, reality set in, and I realized I didn't know these women at all. They were available, so I had no need for them. I had to get back out there and try to make them make the turn. That's why I slept with so many women. I was trying to recreate my childhood and win. I knew none of this at the time, of course. I just thought something had gone wrong with them. Surprise, surprise, everyone. Canadian actor boy had some major mommy issues. But I was 19, and life quickly moved on for everyone. A year later, Van Halen released the aptly titled For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, and I went back to trying to pick up women at the Formosa and trying to recreate the turn as often as humanly possible. Sometimes it worked, but every time I left at 1:40 to rush to the nearest liquor store so I could score more vodka and keep drinking into the night. I'd sit there emptying the bottle, eventually the one with the handle, watching The Goodbye Girl or even Michael Keaton's movie, Clean and Sober, figure that one out, until, just like Eddie Van Halen, I passed out. A needling thought had begun to enter my brain, too, not a huge one, but nonetheless. You're drinking every night, though this thought was quickly washed away by the next drink. And every next day I'd managed to drag myself to lunch where I would meet Craig Bierko, to this day by far the fastest comic mind I have ever seen. I thought my mind was fast, but no, it was Craig Bierko. Hank Azaria became the richest one of the group because he'd been doing a voice on The Simpsons since 1955. I was to be the most famous, and David Pressman was to be a journeyman actor just like his dad, Lawrence Pressman, and the craziest. David loved to do things like run naked into a supermarket shouting, "I have horrible problems, someone please shave me," and then run out. He did this well into his 40s. I sometimes joined him in disrobing in public, though I quit in my mid-30s because I'm the mature one. To this day, no one has made me laugh as hard as Craig Bierko. Being funnier than Hank, David, and me as the threesome was pretty much impossible, but Craig managed it. Being funnier than Hank and me without David was also unheard of, but Craig managed that too. We would go out to lunch, and Craig would say something that was so funny that 15 minutes later after lunch had finished, And I was driving home. I had to pull over to the side of the road because I would still be laughing. And Craig would drive by, see me laughing, and know why. There was no one funnier than Craig. No one. The other thing that drove our friendships, besides trying to be the quickest, the funniest, was fame. We were all absolutely desperate to be famous. Hank, being the voice of The Simpsons, had the most lucrative gig, but it was not the Al Pacino career he longed for. As for me, well, I had done plenty of TV, but nothing that had even remotely brought me fame. And fame, 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 that's all any of us ever cared about. In between the laughter and after we'd shared the latest stories of auditions gone awry or scripts we'd read and hated, the quieter moments were filled with a profound worry, a quiet yearning, and a fear that we would never make it, that fame would just somehow pass us by. We were four strong egos, four funny men, the bon mot flying about like shrapnel. But the battle raged on, the battle for fame. I held firm in my belief that fame would fill the unaccompanied hole in me, the one Valerie refused to fill. But now it was just me and vodka attempting and failing this seemingly impossible task. When fame finally happened, well, we're coming to that. I once made out with David Pressman, or tried to, though I didn't mean to either way. When we were in our early 20s, he and I and a couple of other guys headed east to Vegas to do the Vegas thing. We basically had no money, but that had never stopped four idiots heading to Sin City. I think I had about $200 in my pocket. The four of us rented one motel room off the strip with two beds. I shared a bed with David. In the middle of the night, I guess I was dreaming about Gabby, my ex, and was inching closer and closer to David, saying things like, "Aw, baby," and "You smell so good," and "I promise I'll be quick." He, too, was mercifully asleep, but his subconscious had the wherewithal to keep saying no and back up and leave me the fuck alone. Eventually, I started kissing the back of his neck, which caused us both to startle awake. Seeing the horrified look on his face, I said, "Oh, just forget it," and scuttled back to my side of the bed. Clearly, we all needed some release. The first night, we hit the tables, and somehow I lucked into something, winning $2,600 at blackjack, which was the most cash any of us had ever had. It was time to spend it unwisely. I lifted up my arms like a king, exclaimed, "I'm getting everyone laid." A cab driver took us way out of town to a place called Dominion's, a place he promised would satiate our needs. He received, presumably, a cut for every set of foolish young men he deposited at Dominion's in the desert. To even gain ingress to this fine establishment, we were informed by a man with no neck that somebody had to drop at least a grand, and, as I'd done well on the tables, that privilege fell to me. In fact, I ended up plopping down $1,600 on a single bottle of champagne, at which point we were each escorted to a separate boxy room where a young lady awaited each of us. I figured the $1,600 I'd spent would be good for what I had hoped would come next, but sadly, I was mistaken. In fact, I wasn't going to be taken at all unless I proffered another $300, which I duly did. But before I could graduate to the business end of the evening, David Pressman and the other two guys appeared at my door, needing their own $300 stipend. Their financial needs met, I returned to the matter at hand. It didn't occur to me to do the math, but here it is in case you need it. I started with $200, won $2,600, dropped $1,600 on the champagne, and ponied up an additional $300 each for a total of $2,800. Everything I had. With the financial commitments in place, the young lady proceeded to start dancing at me, a ways off on the other side of the room. And though she gyrated in a perfectly acceptable, if slightly Roxbury girl's manner, I was ready to take our relationship to the next level. "What the hell's going on?" I said obliquely. "What?" she said. What? We're supposed to be having sex, I said. I've spent a small fortune in here. Then she explained to me, for some reason, that I could arrange the pillows wherever I wanted to. That's wonderful, and I'm really excited about the pillow thing. I really am. But aren't we supposed to be doing something else right about now? I asked, begged. Are you the police? She asked. No, I said, though I was beginning to wonder if I should call them to report a fraud. I paid you all that money. We had a deal. Oh, she said, interrupting me. That was just for the dance. At that point, a rapping on the door alerted me to the fact that each of my cronies had faced the same disappointing fate. But as we were thoroughly out of money by this point, with tears in our eyes, four taken, though not taken, losers stepped out into the inky black of the Mojave and began the long walk back to the motel. One of my friends, Nick, did get to take his girl to Young Guns 2 the following day. So that's something. And there were a lot of unanswered questions in the original Young Guns. In 1994, Craig Bierko was the hot item in that particular pilot season. All of us were running around auditioning for the latest slate of sitcoms and dramas, but Craig was the one everybody wanted. This, and he was quicker with a line than me. He was also much better looking than me, but let's not go into any more of that. We don't want a crying author on our hands. I should have hated him, but funny always wins. So I decided to keep loving him. I was 24, and already I was missing 50% of my auditions. I was tailing out as an actor. Drinking was slowly but surely winning the war against auditions, and no one was really interested in me anyway. I wasn't getting any movies, and the roles I got in TV were hardly setting the world alight. I was hung over half the time. The rest of the time, I was on my way to lunch or the Formosa. My manager sat me down one day and told me that the people I aspired to be, Michael Keaton, Tom Hanks, all possessed the attitude I was shooting for, but they also looked great. And he was getting daily feedback from casting directors and producers that I looked like a mess. Hank, too, was starting to get worried that he was wasting his life away and stopped coming to the Formosa and the funny lunches. He was always very serious about his body and his career. I shouldn't have been surprised, but around that time, I got a phone call from my then business manager. Matthew, you're out of money. How about a little warning? I said, scared to death. Did it occur to you that a few months ago you could have given me the heads up? You know, via a call in which you said, hey, Matthew, your funds are looking a bit anemic, instead of waiting till I was now broke? There was silence on the other end of the line, as though keeping tabs on someone's income before they were broke was an entirely new concept for a business manager. Fortunately, I had just about enough juice in me to book a part in a terrible pilot. Hanging up with my now former business manager, I called my agents and told them I was out of money. I needed a job, something, anything, and it had to be right then. If, gentle listener, you're imagining that's how I got friends, you might want to cool your jets. That call led to the show that almost stopped me from getting friends. LAX 2194 was a sci-fi comedy about baggage handlers at Los Angeles International Airport. You could really stop there, but there's more. Those numbers in the title give away the twist. It was set 200 years in the future, and the air travelers would be aliens. The show would star Ryan Stiles as an automaton office manager with a weird accent. Seriously, Ryan was a hilarious actor, but what was with that accent? And me, as the poor guy who had to be the lead in this mess and sort out the baggage issues for the arriving aliens, who happened to have been played by little people in ridiculous wigs. If all this sounds underwhelming, please know that it was way worse than that. I had to wear a futuristic shirt for a start. Despite my misgivings, to repeat, it was a comedy about baggage handlers set 200 years in the future where aliens are played by little people, The pilot paid me $22,500, so I was set for drinks and food at the Formosa for a while. But it did something else, too. Because I was attached to LAX-2194, I was thereby off the market for other shows. Then, disaster struck. I don't mean LAX-2194 got picked up for a season. That never happened, thank God. What did happen was a script for a new show called Friends Like Us